So the current Syrian refugee crisis has been much on my mind and my heart lately. Perhaps you too saw that heartbreaking photo of Aylin Kurdi, the 3-year-old Syrian boy whose body washed up on the shore. His small body lays there face down in the sand, dark hair, red t-shirt, blue shorts, little shoes that someone who loved him probably helped him put on maybe that morning. You almost wish, you hope against hope, that maybe he is sleeping. But he drowned along with his brother and mother as they desperately attempted to cross the sea. Around 11 million Syrians have been displaced, either within Syria or to surrounding and often inhospitable countries. Over half of the refugees are children. 500,000 are pregnant women. They are all humans who have chosen desperate measures to save their lives and their families' lives. Yet in much of America, as you probably know, Syrian refugees have been seen as threats. U.S. Representative Michael McCaul said that accepting Syrians would create a federally funded jihadi pipeline to the U.S. Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina has warned that we have to be very careful about who we let enter this country. We know that these arguments extend not just to Syrians, but to most any refugee or immigrant to this country who we consider not white, affluent, and Christian. Those who argue that refugees are leaving their countries in order to carry out terrorist plots fundamentally misunderstand what it is to be a refugee. Aylin Kurdi's father challenged us, saying, "We are human beings, just like Westerners." Most immigrants are abandoning the home that they love because if they don't, they will die. The Somalian poet Warsan Shear describes this in the following poem I will read. And I will post the audio on our church Facebook page because I encourage you to hear her read it in her own voice. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. Your neighbors running faster than you, breath bloody in their throats. The boy you went to school with, who kissed you dizzy behind the old tin factory, is holding a gun bigger than his body. You only leave home when home won't let you stay. No one leaves home unless home chases you, fire under feet, hot blood in your belly. It's not something you ever thought of doing until the blade burnt threats into your neck. And even then, you carried the anthem under your breath, only tearing up your passport in an airport toilet, sobbing as each mouthful of paper made it clear that you wouldn't be going back. You have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. No one burns their palms under trains beneath carriages. No one spends days and nights in the stomach of a truck feeding on newspaper unless the miles traveled mean something more than journey. No one crawls under fences, wants to be beaten, wants to be pitied. No one chooses refugee camps or strip searches where your body is left aching, or prison, because prison is safer than a city of fire, and one prison guard in the night is better than a truckload of men who look like your father. No one could take it. No one could stomach it. No one's skin would be tough enough. The go home blacks, refugees, dirty immigrants, asylum seekers, sucking our country dry, niggers with their hands out, they smell strange, savage, messed up their country, and now they want to mess ours up. How do the words, the dirty looks, roll off your backs? Maybe because the blow is softer than a limb torn off. Or the words are more tender than 14 men between your legs. Or the insults are easier to swallow than rubble, than bone, than your child's body in pieces. I want to go home, but home is the mouth of a shark, home is the barrel of the gun. And no one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore, unless home told you to quicken your legs. Leave your clothes behind, crawl through the desert, wade through the oceans, drown, save, be hungry, beg, forget pride. Your survival is more important. No one leaves home until home is a sweaty voice in your ear saying, leave, run away from me now. I don't know what I've become, but I know that anywhere is safer than here. It breaks our hearts, right? And our faith calls us to respond to that heartbreak with action. Because our principles affirm the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. But our principles are not easy things. How do we strive for that goal? I have spent days immersed in the Syrian refugee crisis, the complex politics, and social issues. But the how came to me, at least one how. Radical hospitality. By radical hospitality, I mean something like revolutionary hospitality. Hospitality that revolutionizes our relationships with one another. For only a profound revolution can heal this brokenness. And by radical hospitality, I also refer to the etymology of the word radical, related to root. The root of hospitality is about inclusion and exclusion, welcoming someone in to our spaces and our hearts. But where we usually fall short is when that person is different from us. How can we make someone feel comfortable when we ourselves are uncomfortable? In the face of diversity, most of us retreat. That's what Robert Putnam, the Harvard political scientist, wrote based on his research of Americans' declining social engagement. He said, levels of trust and interaction are highest when people are surrounded with those most like them. As the U.S. becomes more heterogeneous, people have stopped reaching out and instead hunker down, stay inside, maintain fewer friendships, watch TV, and engage in fewer community projects. Let us ask ourselves how often I am surrounded by people like me. Are there certain parts of town I don't ever go in? Certain kinds of people with whom I rarely have conversations? There's been a Twitter campaign of people posting photos of themselves with signs saying, "Welcome, refugees." The hospitality there is heartwarming, but we must be clear about what it requires of us. Too often in the U.S., even those immigrants we have enthusiastically welcomed have then had to dissolve their differences into our melting pot. Differences often make us uncomfortable. The Quaker educator Parker Palmer wrote, "The essence of hospitality is that we let our differences, our mutual strangeness, be as they are, while still acknowledging the unity that lies beneath them." Letting differences be as they are can be challenging, even to those of us who consider ourselves very accepting. I have a personal story about it. After college, I did an internship with the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque. I sought out that experience because I had become disheartened by the so-called service trips that my college hosted. Too often, it felt like our service was really self-serving. So the Center for Action and Contemplation said they hosted a different kind of trip. We went to both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. But we didn't build any schools or teach English or any of the other things I had done on service trips. We were there to explore the sentiment expressed by the Australian Aboriginal activist Lila Watson. She said, "If you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together." So we stayed in Juarez with a community of people who had been forced to build their houses, mostly made out of particle board, on top of old landfills. Sometimes in the heat, buried hazardous waste ignites and burns down their homes in minutes. Like I say, we didn't really do much when we were there. The goal was instead to listen and to learn. This meant there was little to shield us from some pretty raw situations. So one morning there, I was eating breakfast with the family I was staying with. The mother was looking around her small kitchen at her dirt floor. You couldn't really even call it a dirt floor, as it was mostly compressed garbage. But she asked me, I swear without any note of anger or judgment or self-pity, she asked me, just like she was making conversation, you probably have a carpet in your house at home, don't you? In that moment, the discomfort I had felt throughout our stay there, the glaring reality of my privilege, was laid bare. I could not run from it. Part of me wanted to say, ridiculously, no, I swear I live like this too. Right? Or, yes, but here, I will give you money to buy carpet. Or, yes, but I'll give it all up and trade places with you. Those responses were all about wanting to flee the discomfort and erase the differences. But none of the responses made sense. She didn't want handouts. She didn't want my middle-class white guilt. She just wanted someone to witness the struggle she was in, to support the courageous, difficult work she was doing to raise her family. So I responded simply, yes, I have carpet. And we kept eating our rice and sitting there next to each other. Parker Palmer said, when we are insecure about our identities, we create settings that deprive other people of their identities as a way of buttressing our own. The women living in that old landfill told us that well-intentioned North Americans would come through the landfill in their SUVs, not even step out of their cars, and just hand money out the windows. They told us that when this happened, of course, many would run to grab some money, but it felt degrading, and it nurtured hostility between the neighbors. Now, of course, it is totally valid for us to send money to people in need. We can use our privilege in many concrete ways to help others. I have even included in the announcements for today links to petitions and funding sources related to Syrian refugees. And after church today, there is a lunch with James Dupross, that's a very powerful direct action agency. But when it comes to solving the root of humanity's brokenness, it will require a deep shift in our ways of relating. When we were with that community on the landfill, we couldn't distract ourselves from the fear and discomfort. We faced a vulnerable encounter with the other. These encounters can shift paradigms. I remember when same-sex marriage passed in Maine when I was living there. The organizers credited the success to the one-on-one personal conversations that they created between people, between voters, people who thought differently. In their book, Radical Hospitality, Benedict's Way of Love, Father Daniel Holman and Lonnie Collins-Pratt say, hospitality is a spiritual practice, a way of becoming more human, a way of understanding yourself. Hospitality is both the answer to modern alienation and injustice and a path to deeper spirituality. So just to close, how is embracing difference a spiritual practice? Because in that vulnerable encounter with something other than us, we can encounter the beyond. We find that we all are held, despite or even because of our differences, in the unity that lies beneath, as Parker Palmer said. Radical hospitality is a spiritual practice because it requires of us courage, compassion, and being in community. Let us practice radical hospitality with ourselves, with each other, and with our neighbors near and far. Then we will truly know the reality that we are not separate from each other. Blessed be.